You're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And this is Truth Quest with Melody. And we're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and Truth Quest programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And this evening I've got three co-hosts kind of sitting here. They're just observing, really, and they're from the junior high school here and middle school, sorry. And this is Mikey and Coral and my granddaughter Alyssa. And I'm kind of getting them to see if they have an interest in the community radio. And before I get started, I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And if you have any questions for the program, you can email us at khen.dj@gmail.com, and we can go ahead and ask our guest if you have an interest in asking her a question. And let's see it. And I want to put a preface before I get introduce you to our guest. And I just want to say I'm not sure I was ever intent to cover the subject of my program on tonight, which is UFOs. But that's not because it's a subject that would be taboo. I just never figured I would go there. But I found that there are questions out there that fit this subject as well as all the other subjects out there that we've covered on this program. And back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I was quite interested in the subject of UFOs, but found that the information I was coming across was lacking, and so I kind of put it aside. So this summer, I got the opportunity to attend a MUFON event in Denver and was able to look closer at the subject of UFOs and found that out there is a relationship with our government and cover-ups and many other events going on in our world, and the subject of UFOs is one of them. How much evidence is enough? And what does the subject of UFOs fit? A similar response from government officials is trying to get at the videotapes of the Pentagon on 9/11. And it's just, I think there's a lot of questions going on out there. And if we're not allowed to ask questions, it doesn't matter what the topic is. And this is why I feel that it's important to bring someone who has done a great job of bringing out a book called UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And this is Leslie Kane. She's an independent investigative journalist with a background in freelance writing and radio broadcasting. She's contributed articles to dozens of publications here and abroad, including the Boston Globe, Philadelphia Inquirer, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Providence Journal, International Herald Tribune, Globe and Mail, Sydney Morning Herald, Bangkok Post, The Nation, and the Journal for Scientific Exploration. Her stories have been syndicated through Knight Rider, Ritter, Tribune, Scripps Howard, and New York Times Wire Service, Pacific News Service, and the National Publishers Association. While spending many years reporting on Burma, she co-authored Burma's Revolution of the Spirit, The Struggle for Democratic Freedom and Dignity. And she's contributed essays for a number of anthologies published between 1998 and 2009. She was also a producer and on-air host for a daily investigative news program on KPFA Radio, a Pacifica station. And in 2002, she co-founded the Coalition for Freedom of Information, an independent alliance advocating for greater government openness on the information about UFOs and for responsible coverage by the media based on an rational and credible approach. As director of the CFI, she is the plaintiff in a successful 4-year Freedom of Information Act federal lawsuit against NASA. Kane was a producer for the 2009 independent documentary, I Know What I Saw, and is currently working with Breakthrough Films, an award-winning film company, on a new feature documentary. Welcome, Leslie.
Well, thank you very much, Melody. It's great to be with you.
Well, I did a quick breeze through your book, and, you know, there's a lot of good information in there. And I'm going to just kind of turn it over to you and just let you go and tell us why you wrote this and what it all means.
Okay. Well, you know, that's a big topic, but we'll start off. I'll give you kind of an overview of the book. As you said, it's called UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And the reason it has that title is that the book includes numerous accounts actually written by these officials. So it's not just me as a reporter quoting them or telling you what they say. It's actual chapters written in the first person exclusively for this book by very high-level officials, including five generals, a former U.S. governor, a former official head of actually the FAA's Accidents and Investigations Department, and a foreword by John Podesta. And, you know, it's just loaded with first-person accounts by these high-level people. So that's sort of one of the very special aspects of it that I think is different. And the other thing is that I am a journalist, as you described in your opening, who has been looking into this from a journalistic perspective for over 10 years. And, you know, there aren't many journalists that have really stuck with this topic the way I have, because it is sort of a strange topic to be interested in. But I've been very, very focused on it and have published numerous stories on it. So I think I'm really putting out there the kind of information that is acceptable to the mainstream, that's corroborated, that's very well documented, that's factual, and that really is pretty irrefutable. And, you know, I have the training as a journalist to be able to discern what information is appropriate to put out and what isn't, and I have very high standards for that. So the information, everyone buying this book or reading it can be assured that the information is very carefully backed up and is the real deal. And it's not, you know, what we have here is a picture of a phenomenon that is incredibly mysterious and behaves in certain ways that are repeated. It's definitely something that we cannot explain. It's been seen for decades, and I do present some of the best cases to make that point. And it's very, very exciting to read about this phenomenon. And I'm hoping that one of the purposes of the book is to request a new office within the United States government that can sort of be a focal point for this, and that hopefully we will get a more thorough investigation with the United States cooperating with other countries to really try to learn more about what UFOs actually are and to try to really get to the bottom eventually of the mystery and hopefully come to a determination as to what they actually are. That's sort of the goal of the book, to try to set in motion a new approach through government and through the scientific community to address the mystery of this.
Do you find that it might be easier to go on an international basis to set up some kind of an investigative approach than going directly through our government?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point, because an international investigation is kind of already underway, because many countries have their own official agencies, actual government agencies that are tasked to investigate UFOs. And the problem is, you know, some of these countries, France as an example, have had agencies for a long time, and they have accumulated a lot of really excellent data and a lot of great information and case reports on UFOs. But there's still this mystery. There still hasn't been the kind of breakthrough that we need, really. And the countries themselves actually feel that until the United States is part of this process, we're really probably not going to kind of break through whatever this barrier is to really getting to the bottom of it. So it's what it really boils down to is not just appealing to the United States, but actually inviting the United States to become part of an investigation that's really already underway. We just want them to be a participant, because the resources that the United States has access to and all the brilliant scientific minds that we have in our country are really needed to help. So it's more as a partnership than as something that we're actually depending on the U.S. government for, but we do need the participation of this country to move it forward. I think that's pretty clear.
Do you find that there's other journalists that are being as investigative into and as forthright in trying to bring out this kind of information, other than just the sensationalization of it?
Yeah, I mean, there are some, definitely, and, you know, there's Billy Cox is one of them, who has a fantastic blog, and Linda Moulton Howe is another person. I think what I've been fortunate enough to have access to very mainstream media, because I was always sort of involved with the mainstream, and I think a lot of the more independent journalists that are interested in this subject, you know, don't have that kind of access. So, but yes, there are other journalists that are definitely interested in this and have been working on it. So, you know, it's just very hard. Everybody who does it faces a lot of obstacles in terms of getting their voices heard.
Do you find that did you get any major resistance in trying to take up this subject?
Well, you know, I've actually been, it really hasn't been that much of a problem. I mean, in the beginning, and this was like 1999 when I started with this, I certainly had my own issues with it. I mean, I was very secretive about it at first. I was worried that I would be ridiculed and that people would, you know, think I was ridiculous to be interested in the subject. There was such a taboo about it. And I was, you know, just worried and professionally concerned that it would affect my career and blah, blah, blah. But once I published my first story in the Boston Globe, which I published in the year of May of 2000, it was a serious piece. It was a long piece. I worked very closely with an excellent editor at the Globe, and it was, you know, in their Sunday paper. It was a feature, and they put photographs in with it, and, you know, it was a big story, and it was so well received, and there was no ridicule or any kind of problems that I faced after I wrote that article. I think that was sort of a turning point for me where I stopped really worrying about it. I mean, yes, there's always that sort of issue when you're at a party or something and somebody says, oh, what do you do? And you sort of dread having to tell them, well, you know, I would say, oh, I'm a journalist, and I'd sort of try to change the subject, you know, but then it would come down to, well, what do you cover as a journalist? And, you know, there's always this sort of dread that you have about telling people what you do, and I certainly had that for a long time. I mean, there is this sort of scorn factor that people have about the subject, and you can feel embarrassed about it. But I have to say that now that I've got this book behind me, I really don't have those kinds of problems anymore. I feel very confident in my work with this. So it takes a while to kind of get to a place, I think, where you feel comfortable really talking about it. And that's one of the issues we deal with in the book, is the whole problem of the taboo and how we might expose that a little more, understand it better, so that we can hopefully work through it and move on from that.
Well, that was kind of the thing that I noticed when I was at the MUFON event in Denver, is that, you know, there's a lot of credible people with some incredible backgrounds that are invested in this avenue, and it's, again, I mean, when you listen to the amount of events and sightings and things tied around this subject, you have to wonder, okay, when is going to be this breakthrough? Because it can't be from lack of evidence.
You're right. I mean, you're right. There is this extraordinary amount of evidence. And you're also right. I think there are a lot of great people, very credible and talented and serious people involved. You know, lots of great researchers. I mean, there may not be that many journalists, but there certainly are some fabulous researchers who have, as you know, take a scientific approach and have spent a lot of time and energy working on the subject and bringing cases forward and documenting evidence. And, yeah, there is a tremendous amount. And I think, you know, even though we have this tremendous amount of evidence, and we've really had it for a long time, you know, we still haven't really broken through on this issue. And that's why I think we really need to take a major step forward, which is to get the United States government to change its position on this. And otherwise, we're just going to continue to have lots and lots of evidence, lots of new cases, lots of new sightings. And, you know, after a point, there's not a lot more we can learn from that because we already have so much information. So what I'm hoping is we can take a step that we've never taken before, at least since the close of Project Blue Book, when the United States government completely backed off from this. I just don't think that a whole lot is going to change, no matter how much more we learn, if we don't have some kind of radical change. And because, yeah, we have all this evidence, but we still need to go somewhere else, and it's not just about learning more. You know, we have to really get some kind of breakthrough to happen.
Okay, I'm looking at this is on the cover of your book, at last a serious and thoughtful book about this controversial subject. Skeptics and true believers will find a treasure trove of insightful and eye-opening information. This book is bound to set the gold standard for UFO research, and this is by Michio Kaku, PhD, author of Physics of the Impossible. And your book is UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Governmental Officials Go on the Record, and this, I'm interviewing Leslie Kane. And I see that you also have radio. Do you want to give us your website, and do you have an ongoing radio program, or is this a past program?
That's a past program, and I used to work at KPFA Radio, which is in Berkeley, California. It's one of the five Pacifica stations, a very progressive kind of grassroots listener-sponsored station. And I worked there in the 90s, into the early 2000s for many years on the Daily Show, but I'm not there anymore. I do have a website for the book for anyone that wants to contact me, learn more about the book, wants to order the book. We have a blog. I've got a Facebook page that's linked there. That website is UFOsOnTheRecord.com. It's sort of an abbreviation of the book's title, UFOsOnTheRecord.com, and I hope everyone will check that out.
Do you want to get into some of the sightings that you cover in this book, so you can kind of give some examples of the? I mean, because what you do explicitly explain is the fact that, you know, there's tons of sightings out there, but most of them can be explained away from a logical explanation, mm-hmm. and you're focusing in on the 5% that can't be explained.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's a really important point for people to know that, as you just said, 95% of all sightings of UFOs can be explained. And we have to remember that UFO means unidentified flying object. So, you know, there are lots of things we see in the sky that look really strange to us. And often when people file reports, you know, there turns out to be an explanation for them, and there's just many possible things that they can be. But there is this nugget of cases that have a lot of evidence for them. Now, again, they have to have enough evidence for us to be able to eliminate, you know, conventional explanations. And if we don't have enough evidence, we can always say, well, if we only knew more, maybe it would be this or that. So the really important cases are those cases for which there is enough evidence to be able to eliminate conventional explanations for it. And these are cases that have been officially investigated. These are the ones I have in the book. They have been investigated by militaries and by governments. They involve pilots, military personnel, generals who have done case investigations, multiple witnesses. Some of them involve radar, incredible photographs, a whole conglomeration of evidence for each case, so that you're not just depending on one person's story. We have cases that are very, very well documented and officially documented, and these are the ones that are just so compelling and so strong in their evidence that they just cannot be dismissed. There's no way to explain them away. And so a number of those cases have been brought forward in the book. There's others, of course, that the book hasn't been able to include. It's not like these are the only ones, but these are among the best in the world in terms of their level of documentation. And I was fortunate enough for many of them to get the actual people involved in the cases to write about it themselves. Again, that's what's so special about, you know, hearing about some of these cases directly from the people involved. So there are a number of them, and I'd be happy to, if you want to ask me that.
Come to mind, what is one of your favorite ones?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of them, but, you know, the one that opens up the book is the one, it's a story of a UFO wave that took place in Belgium in 1989, 1990, into 1991. And this was an extraordinary circumstance over this small European country. These triangular craft just kept appearing over and over again, seen by hundreds and hundreds of people. Many reports filed, many drawings were made, lots of police witnessed these objects and were very involved with the sightings. And there was a colonel from the Air Force named Wilfred de Brouwer who was assigned the task of investigating these cases by the Minister of Defense. And he was then a colonel. He is now a major general, Major General Wilfried de Brouwer, and he has written a chapter for the book about his process of investigating these events when they took place over Belgium. And, I mean, it is so fascinating to read. There were so many cases. He includes lots of drawings of witnesses. The behaviors of these craft were extraordinary, and, you know, not, we don't have any technology that can do what these craft did, basically, is the statement he makes, which was to hover and then, you know, zoom off at incredible speeds at the blink of an eye, move silently, kind of drift around very slowly and silently, low to the ground with absolutely brilliant, brilliant bright spotlights coming down. So it was fascinating. It's fascinating to read about his process of attempts to explain these objects. And the whole country was mobilized to try and discover what they were. And this was not kept secret the way, you know, things are often kept secret in the United States. Everything was made public. They tried their darndest to figure out what these things were. They sent up F-16s to try and chase them. They set up, you know, radar systems to try and capture them on radar. They had an incredible photograph, which is included in the book as well, which is one of the best UFO photos ever taken, which has been highly analyzed and shows a close-up image of this, one of these objects. And, you know, General de Brouwer went to the highest levels of government in other countries to inquire, is this one of yours? Is this some kind of test flight of some experimental aircraft or some secret technology? And he went to the highest levels and was told no. And, in fact, some of the other governments actually asked him, well, we thought we want to know more about this ourselves. And it was never explained. And to this day, he is convinced that these could not have been technology from any other country, and that therefore the extraterrestrial hypothesis must be considered among, you know, to as an explanation for it. He would like to see much more investigation done, but it's just one of the many cases in the book that is so well documented and so fascinating to read about, and leaves you feeling that, you know, I can't imagine any explanation for this. And so we're sort of stuck with this problem. What are these things?
I mean, there's a point in part of the book, it was one, and I can't remember who it was, that was stating that there's something like thousands and thousands of these sightings that I didn't get the time period that they're talking about. So who's filtering through all this? I mean, is this done on a, you know, individual basis? Is there a community that's filtering through this evidence, or what's going on with that?
Yeah, I mean, it would be great if there was one centralized body that went through all of it, which is, you know, is what I think of when you ask that question. But actually, you know, every country sort of has its own setup, and in some countries, government agencies are actually going through it. They're the ones doing the investigations and going through the information. There are also, of course, many citizen groups that do it. Every country sort of approaches it in their own way. And certainly in the United States, there are groups like MUFON, which is the conference you just went to. Other groups in the United States, the National UFO Reporting Center. There's another group called the National Aviation Reporting Center for Anomalous Phenomena, which focuses on aviation safety cases that involve UFOs. So I think, you know, there are organizations that go through the data, that organize it, that try to help make it accessible to people, that study it and think about it. And in some countries, there are also government agencies that do the same thing. And it's very much sort of, you know, each country is sort of working on its own. And, you know, a number of the people in the book actually have proposed that what we really need is some kind of centralized organization where all the information could be collected and it could be sorted out and studied, you know, all the information in one place. And it would be great if we could develop that at some point. But right now it's very much sort of little pockets of groups, you know, around the world working with the information that's pertinent to their own interests in their countries and their own cases.
Well, one of the things, when I was at this MUFON conference, towards the end they had a panel discussion, and there was someone that stood up and asked the question, you know, first of all, I wanted to know how many of them were 100% sure that it, you know, were these something from elsewhere, or, and then there was, which I was surprised at how many of them answered that they thought that there was good evidence that they thought it was not from this earth. Mm-hmm. And then there was one person that kind of which I think it was Mark D'Antonio, he wasn't quite 100% sure, but this is someone that was observing the photographs and some of the other evidence, and I have a feeling that there's a lot of them out there that also think that this may be more technology from here. So did you run into what are your feelings or what is the evidence there that's pointing in that direction?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that certainly some of those 95% that we talked about, some of those explanations that have been provided for some sightings have turned out to be kind of technology that we might be testing, or back before the S-117, I think it's called, you know, for years that some of the aircraft that we have, stealth aircraft, was kept secret. And so when it would be test flown, people would see them sometimes and think, you know, well, that's a UFO, meaning unidentified flying object. So certainly that can explain some of the sightings. I don't think it explains any of the cases in the book, which are just so detailed and there's so much evidence for them. And it certainly doesn't explain all the cases we have. I mean, you know, you can't, there's no one thing that is going to, that you can sort of hang on to explain away UFOs, especially the cases that occurred 50 years ago, when the technology we had then was so much more primitive than what we have now. And there were many very strong cases that occurred decades ago. So I think that some of the sightings, you know, is certainly can be explained that way, but it by no means will explain away the whole phenomenon. And it's interesting what you said about people having different ideas. I think there are different ideas about what they might be, and certainly the leading one tends seems to be the extraterrestrial idea. But some people have speculated about time travelers, for instance, you know, people from the future coming back, or just some kind of interdimensional phenomenon where there's some kind of other dimension that we can't really perceive, and somehow these objects are crossing over the barrier into our dimension. So there are a lot of different ideas out there about what they might be, but it does seem like the extraterrestrial hypothesis is the most commonly, the one that most people believe is what they are. So, but again, we don't really yet know for sure, so there's a lot of different thoughts about it.
Well, that, one of the things that, you know, again, when I, with my opening statements about where I didn't think I would be going in this arena, because, you know, I do try to hit a lot of the conspiratorial subjects that have a lot of evidence that they're, you know, as to why and there are conspiracies out there. And, but I'm finding in the technology, there's a lot of things out there that could explain what you were just talking about, maybe dimensionally or holograms or some kind of, from my understanding, technology-wise, or maybe some kind of cloaking so that something, you can't see something that might be there. So, I mean, I know that I'm kind of torn between, you know, what could be happening, and I do know that you hear a lot of speculation about, you know, the various areas that they do testing of some of the technologies that are out there, and it seems that it would be, if it's, you know, if the government, I can't imagine having an international agency that would pass this information back and forth, and yet at the same time, I think there may be, I mean, you know, that possibility.
Yeah, you mean of creating such an agency?
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, I just think we've got to have a vision of moving forward in some new direction, because where we've been at for so long just cannot, if we keep doing the same thing, we're never going to really break through on this. So whether it be an international agency or whether it just be the United States setting up an office, which is what we've proposed in the book, so that it can become part of this overall picture, something structurally really does need to change, or we're just going to continue to have a lot of great reports coming out about UFOs and not really move forward. So I just hope that we can see some kind of a shift. And we actually have proposed in the book some ideas about how we might be able to achieve an actual concrete change that really wouldn't be all that difficult, but the effects of it could be really dramatic over the long term. Well, so that's what we're hoping for.
One of the other questions that was proposed to the panel was the fact that did we ever think that there would ever be disclosure? And are you familiar with the book, The Report from Iron Mountain?
You know, I don't think I have read it. It certainly rings a bell in my mind, but I wouldn't be able to tell you what it was about, so
well,
I have to say no.
It's a really quite an interesting book, and I was trying to find my copy of it, which came from the Lowry Air Force Base Library, and the first preface of the book is telling it it's a hoax. But when you read the book, you find out everything in it has come true except this sighting of an international UFO event that will bring the whole world together, working together as one. And
mm-hmm.
this was something that was proposed back in the 60s. And it's an interesting little it's a short book, and it's an interesting read, and it gets into the fact that there was a possibly a military I'm doing this from memory here, a
mm-hmm.
group a meeting together in the military that were proposing that down the road this would be an avenue for uniting the world and the aspects and the steps taken to get there. You know, it's well worth
right.
looking at. But
yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting idea, too, the idea of, you know, it you being used to unify the world. I mean, I would hope that if indeed we do discover that there are extraterrestrials visiting this planet, I would hope that that's what happens as a result, and that, you know, we can see ourselves as one planet, one civilization, rather than react in fear and try to attack them or, you know, move into some kind of more militaristic stance. I'm just, you know, it's a nice vision to have, I think.
Well,
one of the reasons to be interested in this is because mm-hmm. it holds that possibility for us. It may hold some really fantastic possibilities for us as a civilization.
Now, the answer that the panel gave, though, it seemed to be pretty much across the board, is that most all of them didn't think that they would have disclosure. They didn't see any reason that our governments would come forward and disclose. Now, I did notice that you had worked some with Stephen Greer in research on your book. Do you have anything to add? I mean, since he was so heavily involved with the Disclosure Project, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I did. It was way back in, 2001, I think, was the year when he gave his Disclosure press conference in Washington. And I was assisting with that, along with a whole group of people, assisting him to launch that press conference. And one of the things I did was to go around and interview witnesses that were eventually, those interviews were eventually put into a video that he put together. Which was a fascinating job for me because I got to go around the country and meet all these fascinating witnesses and talk to them. And then we filmed these interviews. But I have not been working with him since then, just to make that clear. You know, I've just sort of gone off much more on a very kind of factual journalistic perspective. And the kind of work that Steve does is somewhat different than that.
Right.
He's very focused on, you know, trying to make contact and that kind of thing. So, and I think the whole thing about disclosure, I mean, it really depends what you're trying to disclose and how you define the word disclosure. And I think, you know, if it's really being defined as our government announcing that there are extraterrestrials here and that we've known about it for 50 years, you know, or since 1947, I don't think that scenario is going to happen. I certainly would agree with the MUFON panel on that. I don't think that's a scenario that's going to happen or is likely to happen. So I think that's how most people define the word disclosure. But again, we have to be clear how we're defining that before we can really address it.
Well, because what you're talking about is it looks to me like they're moving in that direction, whether the government is admitting it or not. I mean, just by the facts that, you know, if we're putting those facts out into the public for them to look at, even if the government doesn't admit it, it's kind of like 9/11. The government's never going to admit a number of the facts that have been brought out on that, let alone disclosing the, you know, the videotapes of the Pentagon. But in the meantime, you know, the public is, you know, has their own opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of think that maybe that might be what's happening with the UFOs in spite of the government. What do you think?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think it's clear that the government, I mean, when we say the government, we're really talking about lots of little separate agencies that
right.
will have their own little roles to play and everything, but that there certainly is more information locked away than we've been allowed to access, and therefore there's likely to be certain agencies that have some knowledge that we don't know about yet. And, you know, we don't know to what extent that's the case, to what extent there may be research going on and what these agencies know and don't know. But I think it's pretty clear that they likely know some place, you know, some deep, dark places, there is probably some more information hidden away than we have access to as the public. So, yes, we have to sort of come to our own conclusions and take our own positions, which I think people do, and keep asking the government to release this stuff. But I think you're right. It happens in lots of different arenas where it's very hard for people to gain access to information about sensitive topics.
I mean, how are they going to keep the public quiet when there's so many people around the world that are getting to see some of these events?
It's true. I mean, there's just this sort of blind denial that goes on within our agencies, even though, as you say, it's so clear that so many people see these things. And even when they happen right in front of our face, for instance, the case in 2006 at O'Hare Airport in Chicago, I mean, this is happened right in front of our noses, and the government agencies still did their very best to ignore it, and when they were pressed for an answer, they just come up with some ludicrous explanation that has nothing to do with the data that we have on the case, and that's as far as it goes. So, you know, we really have a serious problem here for people that want to learn more about this. The government is not cooperating with that process.
Now, many of these events that you have in your book go back to, you know, how far back do they go?
Well, they're all after the close of Project Blue Book, which I think is important, because when Project Blue Book closed, that was a real turning point in the history of our country with respect to UFOs. The first case, I think they start in the 70s, and we have one from Iran that was 1976. Which I believe is the earliest case in the book, all the way up through a recent case, which was in 2007. So that's sort of it spans, I guess, those 30, 40 years between the mid-70s to very recent times.
Now, why did you pick after Project Blue Book, though?
Well, I wanted to focus more on recent cases just because, you know, there's more information. Usually they just have more information. The people are still alive. I mean, it just boils down to that, too, that you want to have cases where the witnesses are still around to write about them, as they did in my book, or to talk about them or to provide data. And when cases are older, you know, you just don't have the same volume of information. And a lot of the older cases have been discussed a lot more, too, because they've been around longer. So I did include some cases that people know quite a bit about, but we were able to provide more detail on those cases, and I just thought that the more recent cases were going to have more impact as well on government officials, who are the people I really want to be reading this book. I mean, if all the cases are from the 50s, they could say, well, 50s or 60s, well, that was so long ago, you know, we're not going to pay a lot of attention to something that happened 40 years ago, but when something happened 3 years ago, you know, it's going to have more of an impact. It's just sort of the way it works for both the media and for people in government.
Okay, we're speaking with Leslie Kane, who wrote the book UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And this is on the New York Times bestseller list, am I correct?
Yes, actually it has been for a couple of weeks, which is totally amazing and exciting to me. But you're right. It has been. It's been doing very well, gotten a lot of good media coverage, and made it on the New York Times bestseller list. So, I'm very pleased about that.
And is this your first major work, it's your first major work in this arena? Because you did do something else here on Burnham,
right. I mean, I've done a lot of work in this arena that has involved publishing articles, but it's my first book related to UFOs, and I've co-authored some other books before this. This is actually the first book I've done by myself, and certainly the first book on the UFO topic that I've ever done. So it's really a milestone for me, actually, a really important you know, kind of culmination of 10 years of work that I've really put a lot into. So I'm, you know, it's really, I feel, more important than anything else I've done in my journalistic life. So it's a big deal, and I'm just thrilled with the response it's had.
And now you dealt with the cases that are more recent, but did you delve into the history of the UFO phenomena going back, you know, even before maybe 1947? Did you get into that at all?
Well, not really before the 1940s. I did cover starting in the 1940s, which is sort of when there was a lot of sightings that began to be reported, and you had some of the famous early cases. And then going into the 50s, where you had the U.S. Air Force actually setting up its official agency, which became Project Blue Book, and the Robertson panel, which was the secret CIA panel that was convened, where, you know, they all got together and spent a few days and came out with this report saying that UFOs need to be debunked and ridiculed as a way of managing all these reports that were coming in. So I do talk a lot about that period of time in which sort of pattern got set up for the debunking and the ridiculing of UFOs. It's really interesting to look at the role the CIA played. I don't think many people know that. They, you know, a lot of people in the culture just sort of laugh about UFOs without really thinking about it. And I think, you know, it's surprising to people to learn that this was a conscious, you know, choice that was made by the CIA panel to encourage our government agencies to use debunking as a tool to kind of minimize the volume of reports and get people to stop being so concerned about these UFOs. So it's pretty fascinating. I think the history is really, really interesting, and I do cover that in the book, definitely.
Well, you know, I find a lot of these same kinds of debunking goes along with anything that is outside the realm of where the media and powers that be want us to go. And that's what made me even as much or more curious and to start looking at this subject, because they're using a lot of the psychological techniques that they do with 9/11 or other subjects that have been, you know, kind of put in the terms of conspiratorial.
Yeah, and I have to confess, I don't know very much about the other areas because I've been so focused on this one for so long.
Well, I'm not trying to get you into those subjects on purpose, but
sure.
Because I mean, I realize this is your area that you have been focused on, but I'm just, what I'm trying to state that is that you, any time that there's something that it seems like they want to steer the public away from, they kind of use a lot of the same psychological techniques, and the UFO is probably one of the oldest ones around.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. I'm sure that, yeah, you can see parallels in lots of different areas. And, yeah, this is old. I mean, this really started in the late 40s, early 50s, when they started having to grapple with the fact that there were all these reports that they couldn't explain, and then they figured out they weren't Russian, and they were really stuck. You know, the officials did not know what to do. They didn't know what to tell people. So it goes way, way back.
Yeah, and, you know, and I've actually even come across accounts that go back into the 1800s on sightings.
Yeah,
And yet, you know, and I realize, again, that's not where what you tried to cover in this book, but, you know, this was before a lot of that technology could have even been hardly even, you know, thought about.
Exactly. I mean, we didn't even have airplanes, you know. No, I think those really, really early reports are fascinating, and also the paintings that show, you know, things that look like UFOs, I mean, round things in the sky with light coming off them or whatever. I mean, we don't know for sure, but there are these historic paintings and reports as well of things that appear to be UFOs, so that, I think that's a really, really interesting aspect of all this.
And so when we get into, when you mentioned something about interdimensional and did you get a chance to really look at some of the technologies that are out there when you were doing some of these interviews with some of these military personnel and others that may have been privy to things?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I didn't really study the technologies myself because, you know, it's just sort of like I'm not probably, you know, expertise in engineering or that kind of stuff. But, you know, I really did rely on the testimonies of the experts that do know the technologies, though, and were able to tell me that, you know, this is what things, we can do these things, but we can't do those things, and were able to tell me, as far as I know, being them being the expert, you know, this, we don't have technology that can do this, that, and the other thing. So it was more talking to people about their, you know, what their views are, people that are in a position to know, rather than me actually studying the technologies myself. I kind of left that up to them. But I'd like to know more about them. It certainly would be interesting, but I can't claim to be an expert on that at all.
Well, I realize you didn't really try to cover that, but that is the most fascinating part to me about the whole mm-hmm. thing, and that's why I still have to come back and look at this subject from many different angles, although, you know, as a journalist and trying to document everything, that seems to be where a lot of the another avenue and layer of secrecy or inability to get at things. Now, you get into the FOIA requests. What has been your experience with this along this subject?
Well, and that's a whole other area, too, that really is sort of independent of the book, but I was for many years involved with a freedom of the U.S. came down in Pennsylvania in 1965 in this tiny little town called Kecksburg, which is just southeast of Pittsburgh. And this case has been very well documented by a researcher who lives in Pennsylvania named Stan Gordon. And for decades, I mean, he started looking into this the day it happened, actually, when he was a teenager, and has spent his whole adult life studying this case. So when I got involved in about 2002 with a professional group of people that were supported by the Sci-Fi Channel, who had launched this initiative to try to get to the bottom of this case through the Freedom of Information Act, which meant, you know, making requests to various agencies. And what we had decided was we were not going to take no for an answer. And we hired a law firm. And we had this law firm, we had a lawyer who was an expert in dealing with Freedom of Information Act issues, representing our group, which we called the group the Coalition for Freedom of Information. And we focused in on NASA because we knew that NASA had documents on this Kecksburg case. Initially, it told us it didn't have the documents that we knew it had. And the funny thing was, we were able to go back to NASA and say, you know, it wrote back and said, I'm sorry, we don't have anything, you know, that pertains to your request. And we had requested maybe five different categories of documents. And it just so happened that we already had in our files a number of documents from NASA that were relevant to our request. So we were able to write them back and say, I'm sorry, NASA, we happen to know you do have these documents because here they are. Here are copies of them. You already released them years ago. And so they go, whoops, okay, you win this round. And we actually won an appeal against their no records response, which is what it's called when they write back and say, we have no records responsive to what you wanted. We were able to appeal that and win it because we actually had the documents to prove it. Then we ended up going into federal court because NASA was still withholding lots of information from us, and we got involved in a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, for which I was the plaintiff, and it went on for many years in federal court, and the judge was very supportive of our side of things. And eventually in 2007, we settled with NASA, and it was in our favor, dramatically in our favor, and they were required to send hundreds and hundreds of documents to us. That all should have been, I mean, theoretically, they should have been released from the very beginning if they were following the law. And, you know, starting off with them saying, no, we have nothing, it turned out they had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages that we ended up receiving from them.
Leslie, just a second. If I do lose you here, because I'm starting to get a little bit of interference here, so I'll definitely try to, you know, reconnect with you.
Just hang up if we get disconnected. You can call me back.
Right. But in the meantime, there was much of it redacted when you got the paper.
No, that really wasn't an issue. I mean, because unfortunately, there was maybe a few small places. It was just like a name and an address, let's say, of a citizen that had written a letter inquiring about something. It was more to protect the privacy. But The issue with us wasn't so much redaction as it was the fact that we never actually got documents that explained the case that we were concerned about, namely the Kecksburg UFO case. So we did get hundreds and hundreds of documents.
but it wasn't
requests. Now, they were relevant to the items, you know, the specific terms that we gave them to search under, but they were not relevant to the specific event of the Kecksburg UFO incident. So we really, you know, I mean, it was a very useful process for many reasons, the whole thing. But we did not solve the problem of what came down in Kecksburg, which is what we'd hoped.
Okay,
so,
now,
you know, this is the way it works.
Did you cover the Kecksburg in your book?
Actually not, because, you know, the book is really focused on the high-level officials, and we didn't have any high-level officials from that case that had come forward. So all the information we have on that has been gathered through by a huge number of witnesses. I mean, it's a totally valid case. But the theme of my book is to have these officials actually write their own pieces and talk about the cases, and it just didn't fit that category. But nonetheless, it's something that I've worked on for many, many years and have been very involved with, even though it wasn't in the book. And it's a fascinating case. And on my other website, which is freedomofinfo.org, which is the Coalition for Freedom of Information website, I have a whole report that I've written about the lawsuit, what we learned, what we didn't learn, what, you know, what was valuable about it, and all of this, and all the information about kind of summing up what happened if anybody's interested in reading about it. And it does shed a lot of light on the problems that we face with the Freedom of Information Act. I mean, we're very lucky that we have it. Don't get me wrong, but there are so many problems with it, and it's so difficult to acquire information through it on so many incidences that it needs to be reformed, and there's all kinds of problems. And our efforts were really able to highlight what citizens are up against in trying to get information from the government, not just about UFOs, but I'm sure about lots of subjects.
Okay.
That, it just doesn't work out very well, and we're hoping, you know, that the case sheds some light on that.
Can you kind of refresh the audience what Kecksburg was about, what happened on there?
Sure. It was back in December of 1965, December 9th, 1965, around late in the afternoon, between 4:30 and 5, closer to 5, some kind of an acorn-shaped object was actually seen. First of all, there was a fireball, actually, that was seen over a number of states coming down from Michigan through Ohio. And when you got closer to the actual location of where this thing came down, there were lots of witnesses that saw this craft making controlled turns. I mean, it wasn't something crashing down or going in a straight line. There were actually people that saw it from different vantage points enough to be able to determine that it actually made turns and that it was coming down very gradually. And it finally hit the ground, and a number of people saw it close up on the ground. And it was described as being a kind of an acorn-shaped thing, maybe 9 feet long. They say about the size of a Volkswagen bus was sort of a standard description for it. Strange hieroglyphics written on it along the rim of the object. There were no windows or doors or scenes that were visible to people. And it landed on its side, so they couldn't see the whole thing. But the part that was showing, it just looked like it was one piece of metal with no scenes or windows or anything, with these strange, what people call hieroglyphic markings on it. And there were about four or five witnesses that got close enough to it to really get a good look at it before the military came in. When the military came in, they cordoned off the area where the object had come down, prevented people from getting anywhere near it, and eventually removed it on the back of a flatbed truck. And it was a big deal. It was in the news. People were driving there from all over the area because it had been reported on TV and on the radio that something had come down and that there were military going out. And it was this big event in Pennsylvania, and it was about 1 o'clock in the morning when this flatbed truck finally emerged from the woods with this thing on the back with a tarp over it. And lots of people saw it driving away really fast, driving from the scene. And so there were people that witnessed the object at different stages that night. And Stan Gordon has been collecting these reports and has been willing to put together a very clear picture of what happened. And that was pretty much it in a nutshell. And the Air Force did file some documents on it, which were released through the Project Blue Book files, which were released years later, which stated that a three-man team did go out and search for this object, but that they didn't find anything. And basically the report, the Air Force report, said this was a meteor. Nothing ever came down that night. and nobody ever found anything, which, of course, runs totally contrary to what all these witnesses have reported. And the consistency of the reports that the witness provided, you know, certainly points to a whole different kind of story than what the Air Force has told us. So that's what was sort of intriguing about it to me, is we had this very distinctive contradiction between the witness reports and what the Air Force said. And we wanted to try to find other agencies that we knew would have had documents about this case, you know, because the Air Force had released their documents, but we didn't have them from anywhere else. That's probably one reason we went after NASA. And there were reports of NASA officials on the scene that night from some of the witnesses. And we also knew that NASA was responsible for the collection of space debris and things that fell from the sky. NASA was always very involved with that kind of stuff back in the 60s. So that's why we were convinced that they should have information about this. So anyway, that's the story of the Kecksburg UFO case. And it was one of the reasons we selected it was that it actually involved a physical object. You know, it wasn't just a sighting or something even that landed and took off again. It was actually something that crashed that was retrieved. And therefore, that means that there is a solid physical object someplace that was removed. And that's about, you know, that's physical data, physical evidence that we were very interested in. So, that's why we thought there might be more likely to be documentation about it. But there's still so much more work that could be done to try to acquire documents, and lots of people have been working on it for a very, very long time, and it's just a very tough, very tough case to get the government to release anything on at this point, which is only adds to the intrigue and the mystery of the whole thing. You know, if it was some kind of military test item or some, even a Russian thing that had fallen and that we wanted to collect it and keep it secret, you know, it doesn't really make sense that all these years later, 45 years later or so, that they would still not be willing to inform the public as to what this was. I mean, so it's a very, very mysterious and intriguing situation, but I worked on it for many, many years, and I've now, you know, then I began to focus more on the book. So maybe someday I'll be able to return to that, and I hope others will, because there's a lot more work to be done on that case.
Okay, Leslie, let me go ahead and say this is KHEN-LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, and we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org, and TruthQuest programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. Okay, now back to my guest is Leslie Kane, who's written the book UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. I'd like you to get into a little bit on the Rendlesham incident. Would you like to go there, Leslie?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, again, this is really a complicated case, actually probably one of the more complex ones, because it involves events that happened over a series of different nights, actually. This is in 1980 in the UK at an Air Force base called Bentwaters, actually an American base, which was in England. So the military personnel there were Americans. And it was just, an extraordinary series of events that took place, as I said, over a couple of nights. The first night, there was something that had come down in the woods, and a security team was sent out to check it out. They thought it was probably a downed aircraft or something. And they actually came upon something entirely different, some kind of triangular object that had landed in the woods, and had these sort of swirling lights around it. It was like nothing, you know, there were three men that approached it, nothing like any of them had seen before. And one of the men stayed back and kind of acted as a liaison who was speaking through the radio to the headquarters. Two of them approached the object and made a detailed study of it. I mean, one of them had named James Peniston, was a sergeant. He had a logbook, and he took lots of notes about it, made drawings of it. And it was about, I don't know how, maybe 6 or 7 or 8 feet tall. It was not huge, but it was definitely a triangular-shaped thing. And he also discovered, as I mentioned this in the Kexford case, but here again, the sort of symbols on the craft that he said were sort of like hieroglyphics. They were what he called symbols. He drew them in his notebook, so he had an actual record of what they looked like, and actually took photographs of the object and walked around it and was there for about 45 minutes studying this thing. And then it started to give off more of an electrical charge, and the thing actually took off, and I watched it. It maneuvered through the trees silently and then suddenly just took off at the blink of an eye. And the men went back and reported the incident, and this was actually pretty late at night when it happened. And the next day, a team went out and found all the physical evidence at the site where the thing had landed. There were holes in the ground from where the landing gear had touched down, all in a triangular shape, and burn marks on the trees, broken branches where the object had landed, lots of radiation as well at the site. So the men that had seen it were kind of relieved at that point that the physical evidence was there, you know, to sort of document what they had seen. They could not believe it. And this was just one event. So in the book, James Peniston, the young man who actually touched it as part of his investigation, this was the man who had the lockbook and was walking around the object, he actually touched it at one point as well. And he writes a very kind of emotional account of what it was like to be that close to this thing and what it felt like and what he... You know, he was very, very affected by it and still is today. How he was debriefed afterwards, it was very harsh, the way they were treated afterwards. A lot of the men that were involved with this told not to talk about it. And he has some drawings in the book as well of what the symbols look like, what the object looked like. He made some very excellent drawings. So that's just one part of this event. And a couple nights later, Colonel Charles Holt was out with a team of men, and a lot of objects were seen beaming light beams down. He had his pocket tape recorder and recorded in real time things as they unfolded. And, you know, a very different set of events, but really just as fascinating, although he wasn't as close as Peniston was. But the light beams were really intense. They were landed only a few feet from him. And he filed a document on this, and there were lots of documents filed by witnesses. So this was a huge event with lots and lots of witnesses, lots of documents that exist about it, and all the physical evidence that took place from the thing that landed. So it's a really, really interesting case. And again, in the book, to hear the reports written by the people involved are really, really fascinating. They bring forth a lot more detail than we knew about before, and just provide a very personal experience for the reader of what they went through. Now, and even though the case has been on the record for the while, that's really the new dimension that's added to it through the book.
And this happened when again?
In
1980. Now, yes. If I'm correct here, there was somebody with the last name of Burroughs that was in...
Right, yeah.
And now, is that the Burroughs that I think Linda Moulton Howe has been doing some work with?
It's exactly the man. Yep, he was there with James Peniston, who's the one I was just talking about, with him, and witnessed the same landed craft and was very close to it. And he was the second man that was there. And yes, he's been doing some talks with Linda Moulton Howe and speaking out about this more in the last year or two, I think, than he'd ever done before. And also was very affected by it. And both he and Peniston really want some answers, and we're very affected by it, and still are.
Yeah, he was a very credible story to listen to, and you could definitely tell that, you know, I mean, it really sparked something in Linda.
Absolutely, these are credible men with a real story to tell. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, it really isn't. And there's so many others that were involved with this case. It's, you know, there have been whole books written about just this one case. That's how much information there is.
Okay, well, let's go give us another example here of what another story in this book that you found interesting.
Well, there's a lot of them, but I I find the Iranian case very interesting of 1976, which is probably the earliest case in the book.
Uh-huh.
And that involves a pilot who was then an Air Force, a young Air Force pilot. He's now actually a general in Iran. His name's Parviz Jafari. And he was actually sent up by a general back in 1976 after this object was seen over Tehran one night, a very, very bright object. Lots of people were calling in to the tower and describing this. Citizens were actually kind of frightened about it in Tehran. And at one point, the tower authorities and the general actually stepped outside and looked at it themselves, and they had binoculars, and they decided that we needed to find out more about it. So they sent up two aircraft, actually, each one with two pilots in it. And these were jet fighter planes. And he was in the second one, and what happened was that when they got too close to this object, they would lose control of their radios and their equipment. Couldn't get too close or things wouldn't work properly. And later on, when he was just up there trying to get a better look at it, suddenly these round projectiles, as he called them, came out of this bigger, brilliant object. It was a brilliant kind of strobe. He said it was sort of like a huge strobe light, sort of flashing colors and so bright that he couldn't see any kind of physical shape under it, but just these brilliant, brilliant lights. And this larger, brilliant light thing sent out these smaller, round objects that started heading directly at his plane. This was, again, Jafari's plane. He was the pilot. And he was afraid they were going to collide with him because they were coming right at him. So he said, well, he decided he would shoot to defend himself. And he got a heat-seeking missile all set up, locked into the target of this object that was coming at him. And just at the moment when he was about to fire, he lost control of his equipment. And that happened three or four times. Each time that he was just about to press the button and fire at this thing, he lost control of it. And it was just uncanny. It was as if somehow whatever this thing was knew, and I say this all in quotes, knew, because we really don't know what was going on, but it seemed that there was some kind of intelligence there that recognized that he was about to fire and somehow had the power to disable his equipment at the last minute. It happened numerous times. So that was, and he was really frightened but throughout the whole thing. And again, he writes his own story about this in the book. I'm not telling the story, he does. And he describes some of the emotions that he had while this was going on. And eventually he came back to base, and one of the objects was seen landing, and they went down and tried to find traces of it and couldn't find anything. And he was debriefed extensively by high-level officials in his government and an American colonel who was at this meeting in Iran. And this colonel interviewed him and actually filed a lengthy report about the case for the Defense Intelligence Agency, which was circulated secretly around various agencies in Washington, and has now been released through the Freedom of Information Act. And this is a three-page detailed document about the event, covers all the things that he says happened, and actually assesses it as a very high-level UFO case worthy of, a kind of a UFO case worthy of further study. So it's a very fascinating case to read his own story, and also the fact that the U.S. government documented the case is very important because they had already told the American people when Project Blue Book closed down that they were not going to be investigating UFOs anymore. So we have documents for cases like this that show that, in fact, they were still interested, and they were interested enough to interview this pilot, look into this case, and file a detailed report about it. So that's another case that I think people will find fascinating in the book, especially because it was written by the person involved with it, General Parviz Jafari.
Now, one of the things that I'd heard about Project Blue Book is that it was more of kind of the, they were more of the face for the UFO for the government. They weren't really into giving real information. Have you heard anything about like that, or am I making sense?
No. I mean, I've written a lot about that in the book. That's very well documented that Project Blue Book was like a public relations office.
That's the word I wanted.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. And it did provide a place where people could call up and report sightings, but I don't think anybody would you know, anybody has looked at it, and a lot of people have studied it very carefully. You know, it's clear that they often ridiculed cases. They didn't investigate cases carefully enough. They would offer explanations that didn't necessarily fit, and, you know, tried to dismiss cases and sort of unload them as best they could. They certainly did keep some interesting records, and we learned a lot from the Project Blue Book files. I mean, there were a lot of very interesting cases that were documented, but by and large, you know, it was basically a public relations office, a way for the Air Force to sort of manage all the reports that were coming in and to try to, you know, do away with them as easily as they could, and not really take them very seriously, unfortunately. So there's a lot that's been written about the sad process of all of that. It was terminated in 1970, the whole thing. But it did leave some interesting case records.
Now,
inadequate.
How many people did you interview for this book? Do you have any idea?
Oh, I mean, the book is accumulation of, you know, 10 years of work, and I've interviewed so many people over those years, and sort of, you know, so it's hard to separate out. I mean, all the interviews that I've done over the years have really entered into the body of research that's presented here.
Okay.
But there are, you know, 18 specific individuals who actually wrote for the book, who I call my contributors, who were the contributors to the book. And these, you know, these are a collection of just amazing sources and high-level people who have taken the time to actually write their own original pieces. So they sort of are really contributing more to the book than anybody I've interviewed, because they've actually written their own pieces for it. And among that group are five generals from five different countries and a former American governor and lots of very interesting people. So, you know, of course, I interviewed all of them and in great depth, and there are many others that I've interviewed in the book and also over the years who may not have actually appeared in the book. But, I mean, all the work I did on Kecksburg, for instance, involved lots of interviews with different people. It's just, and they weren't part of the book. So, boy, I have many, many files and tapes and taped interviews and all kinds of information that I've collected over the years. So it would be hard to say.
Now, did many of these people, what kind of obstacles did they have to overcome to speak, or were they discouraged from speaking? Did they have visitations or things that made it difficult for them to disclose what happened to them?
Yeah, I mean, every situation is different, and different people had different kinds of obstacles. Some of them, as you suggested, had been told not to talk about these things, but they're doing it anyway. And the ones that have not had any repercussions as a result of doing that. Others, you know, were official investigators for government offices, so they were not really under any restrictions in terms of talking about it. Although some of them, for instance, head of the French agency for 20 years, has written a chapter for the book, and he states that he's now able to write much more freely and talk more freely and openly about this than he was when he was actually serving the government, because he's retired now. So most of these people are retired, and that gives them a certain liberty to be more open than they might be if they weren't retired. But I don't think any of them have felt a lot of obstacles, although some of them describe being told at various stages not to talk about what happened to them. And they had the courage to do it anyway. So it does vary from person to person in terms of, you know, what restrictions they face. But I think it is important to note that even the ones that have talked about it have never faced any problem because of that. But they certainly wait until they're retired to do it. I mean, that seems to be a given. And we do have some people in the book, though, that are not retired. And one of them is a young captain from the Aviation Army of Chile, who is only in his early 30s, and he's been actually assigned by the military in Chile to investigate these events, to investigate UFOs. and particularly sightings involving pilots. And he's been sort of a government official who has learned a lot about that and is sort of the person that people in Chile come to when they have a case to report, or who pilots go and talk to when they witness something. And he's very active within the military there, and he actually was received permission to write a chapter for the book about his investigations in that in that country. And it's really interesting because he is not a retired person, but was still able to speak openly about his research and his government investigations, military investigations with pilots, and what his thoughts are about that. So, you know, he was an example of somebody with no restrictions on him, even though he's not retired. So I think that runs the whole gamut, from people who were told never to talk about this to people who are given complete freedom to talk about it. And every situation is different.
It seems that I run across a lot of sightings coming out of South America and Mexico. And apparently, when you're talking about this person from Chile, maybe, you know, those countries have a different way of viewing how to, you know, deal with the public on these subjects then. Is that what you're saying here?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that every country is different, but a lot of the countries that I've studied here and are represented in the book are much more open about it than America is. I mean, you have countries with actual government agencies that investigate UFOs openly and report on the findings. They're not keeping secrets from people. So it's very different. And I think that's a point I'm trying to highlight throughout the book, is that the contrast between how the United States deals with UFOs versus other countries. And it's very well illustrated by some of the people from these countries who have written pieces for the book and describe what goes on in their own countries. It's really remarkable how different it is in various South American countries, in France, how it's been in the UK, how it's been in Belgium, a lot of countries. It's really quite handled very differently.
Well, I'm speaking with Leslie Kane, who's written the book UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Governmental Officials Go on Record. And Leslie, you want to go ahead and give your website again and where they can acquire the book?
Sure. The website is UFOsOnTheRecord.com. Sort of like an abbreviation of the title, which is UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. So again, if you go to UFOsOnTheRecord.com, there's buttons there for various booksellers, including Amazon, if you want to buy the book, and it's actually very reduced. I mean, Amazon has the book way off of the list price. It's a very good deal, and makes it easier to order it if you just go to that website. We also have comment boards there. We have a blog with all kinds of postings on it, photographs, information about the book, lots of interesting stuff, and also a link to the Facebook page, which I hope people will visit as well, where we have lots of interesting discussions going on, and all the media that I'm doing is getting posted there. It's been a lot of interest in the book and lots of discussions about it, so I hope everybody will check out the website. Again, UFOsOnTheRecord.com.
Now, are you going to be hitting any of the events, kind of like any MUFON or other type of events that, you know, that they have various other speakers at?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. It looks like I'm going to be at a conference in San Francisco Bay Area at the end of October. Other than that, and there's a MUFON conference actually in Pennsylvania that I'm definitely going to be at in, I think it's on October 16th, in a few weeks, outside of Pittsburgh, and I'm going to be touching on the Kexburg case again on that one. So I have those two events lined up. Other than that, it's I'm not sure if anything else has been set up, but still doing lots of interviews with media on the phone, like I'm doing with you tonight, and speaking out a lot about the book.
Now, as far as what is it you hope, I mean, do you really think you're going to get the momentum to get some other journalists or others to accomplish what your objective was with this book? And you might want to go review that with the audience again. What is your objective with this book?
Well, the deepest level objective is to bring about structural change within the U.S. government in terms of how it approaches the subject matter of UFOs. And so it's, again, we'd certainly like to have other journalists get involved, but that's not really the main goal we're hoping to achieve, which is to set up a small office within the U.S. government, whether it be in NASA or the Air Force or the Department of Defense, someplace, a focal point, an official focal point office, as we have in other countries, that can serve as a official body that can investigate UFO events that occur, that can work on the release of information, that can liaison with other government agencies in other parts of the world, and that when a UFO event occurs in this country, we would therefore, with this office in place, be ready and all set up to do a proper investigation, which this official body would serve as kind of the staff in that office would be the ones to coordinate this investigation. And they would have a network of experts already lined up across the country so that they could get help from the appropriate experts when an event was to be studied. And so it would just sort of raise the bar in terms of changing the approach. And we would no longer have the government ignoring events or, if not ignoring them, making up ridiculous explanations for them that just don't fit. Instead, we would have a proper investigation in which, and the reason we need an official agency is to get the release of information quickly.
Now, do you think that some of these, when you're interviewing some of these other generals and the like, did you get any kind of feedback from them as to whether they thought this might be an achievable thing?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, this proposition was made with the backing of the people in this book, and I've consulted with lots of people. This wasn't just something I just sort of arbitrarily put out there. I mean, this has been something that's been carefully thought through, and, for instance, the former governor of Arizona is certainly somebody who's, Fife Symington, who's standing behind this. So it's not the only, the only option we have, but it's the one that we've put forward as being achievable and as being something that we think can work and can really bring about a major change in approach that could lead to all kinds of doors opening up for this, for the UFO issue. So definitely we think it's something that has a chance of happening for sure, and it's not just has been carefully thought about. Lots of people are behind it.
What about some of the areas? Did you explore at all or come in contact with those that may have worked in some of the secret areas in the U.S.?
No, that not may really. Have been, I mean, what's that?
Were the areas that supposedly some of these craft or evidence may have been taken to?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting, that's an interesting mystery, and I certainly have spoken to people who have reported those kinds of things happening or knowledge of such a secret program where there may have been a craft retrieved or something, but it's not the kind of information that's documented enough or corroborated enough that I feel as a journalist that I can actually bring it forward as valid information. I mean, these are definitely people I respect, and it's fascinating to me, and I certainly sort of store it in the back of my mind, But as a journalist, there has to be a certain standard of information that I can work with, and I don't have enough solid evidence along those lines to be able to say.
What is the criteria that you guys have to live by so that maybe the audience can kind of understand when you're saying that it has to fit journalistic criteria? What is that?
Yeah, I mean, it really has to do with, you need more than one source. For instance, if somebody tells you something that they saw, you want to have maybe two or three other people that also saw it that can independently tell you the same thing. So you're not just relying on one person's story. I mean, that's a big part of it. Another aspect is you want to have documentation if that's possible, which means something that's written down and filed, hopefully officially filed, so that, it's recorded at the time. There are certain facts that are written down about it. There's certain data that's written down, and you can go and check out those facts and possibly find other documents that support it or people that can support it. So, there has to be sort of this body of information, especially when you're dealing with something really extraordinary like this. You can't just sort of say, well, so-and-so told me this, and therefore I'm going to put that out there as something, that's some whistleblower guy who wants to keep his name secret.
Are you there? Did I just lose you? Well, that's interesting. I'll have to get her back here just a second and see if I can put a song on here. And...